Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carroll saying hello and welcome you to the latest BanterCast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. At Banter, we put on public events in spaces and venues of all shapes and sizes. There, a range of interesting people come along to tell stories, talk about their lives and discuss various topics and themes. We record what happens in the room and then we podcast the results. Here's another one from our trip to the Beach Yard in Dunleary last summer, a festival we'll be revisiting in August. Here's Danny Wang talking life and music, past, present and future, in what was one of the best conversations we've ever had at Banter.
Hi folks, welcome back. Welcome to the final Banter Yard experience of the day. We're back tomorrow. We've got a load of more talks tomorrow, so please come back if you're here. But right now, we're going to talk to Mr. Danny Wang about music. Welcome, Danny. How are you?
Hi. I didn't really know this was happening until about 15 minutes ago. I mean, there was an email. Well, I don't know why you'd all sit here listening to people like us talk when there's all that music going on outside.
I don't know. It's interesting. All day long, there's been people sitting here. It's like we since not the same people, not the same people.
They're
like
laughing at us already.
But since we started, people are. It might be a beautiful day. There's loads of music going on, but at the same time, people want to hear interesting people talk.
And that would be me, of course.
That's you. How was your gig?
It went really well. It was surpassed my expectations. I wasn't expecting little, but. I didn't really expect all these break dancers and boogie people to just show up out of the audience, and they were like moonwalking. And maybe you saw it. I mean, it was like a like a spontaneous dance circle that you see in break dance movies.
Oh, brilliant!
Yeah, and it seemed to go on most of the hour that I was playing. Quite shocking. And then a guy wearing a rainbow feather dress or something and a Hawaiian shirt came up and started singing along to Madonna Holiday because it was his birthday, and he was doing synchronized dance moves. And then various moments of...
And you've got glitter in your face.
Huh?
You've got glitter on your face.
I do?
Yeah.
Oh, didn't even look in the mirror. Yeah, I did. I'm not sure if I should be here entertaining you or something. This is very strange.
No. Let's
really, it's like, I have to apologize if it sounds contrived or something. We really didn't know that we were going to do this.
I'm going to have words with our amazing artist liaison people.
No, they did tell me.
And Robin especially, for not warning you what's about this, you know?
Okay, we'll try to make this a substantial, informative conversation for the erudition of all those present.
We had that earlier on with Blind Boy, so this will be more about music. What's the first record you can remember turning your head upside down?
It was Upside Down by Diana Ross. the truth is, this could be kind of interesting because I'm realizing as an adult that I was very gay. Naive child, and my mother was not into the very traditional, I would say not traditional, but Chinese immigrant family in the 60s. And so my mom was very Catholic. She was a nun, and she had sang in church. But according to her Chinese background, music had no value whatsoever. She meant this quite seriously. And she would always say throughout her whole childhood, I'm coming to these horrible realizations about my own life lately, because I think DJ is a very naive path through which I sort of went back and discovered my own musicality, you might say. Because I think in a lot of European countries, like in Ireland and such, it's quite normal for kids to grow up and, you know, parents offer their kids guitar lessons and all that. But in my family, it's quite opposite. My mom only saw other Chinese parents who forced their kids to do piano and guitar, piano and violin. And somewhat correctly, I think, she felt that was just a sort of bourgeois form of showing your kids off and cannot possibly be of any good. So she actually refused to give us music lessons, even though I showed inclinations. Yeah. I played the vibraphone a bit. And my dad was very musical. He played the trumpet and we had a piano in the house. But then he sort of steered everything into a very proper Chinese-American career with an electric company, Pacific Gas and Electric in San Francisco. And so I think, and he used to play records like Grieg, I think, is it Hall of the Mountain King? And we always had like Tchaikovsky running in the house, Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies and all that stuff from The Nutcracker and Sound of Music all the time. And my dad listened to Carpenters. But there was never an attempt. It was just for pleasure. My mom had no part of it. And for my dad, it was just, I don't think he connected it that he could play those things himself or that his children might be interested in taking lessons to learn how to make sense of that stuff. It was just entertainment. Hmm. So I thought, right, this makes it a little more interesting, the conversation.
No, it does, because it's like, you know? It's an interesting dichotomy between your parents. You know, if on one hand your mother is kind of going like, she doesn't see any value in it.
Yeah, she would say that all the time. In fact, here's another one. She would say, because she's very Catholic, very heady about her religion. I know there's some Catholics among you Irish people out here.
They're lapsed.
Right, and she would say, you know, black people have these funny things called gospel churches, and all they do is sing and dance and clap their hands. I don't know what that has to do with Jesus Christ. She would say that quite literally. She meant it.
Yeah. Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ.
But like that's so weird. Like, was her version of Catholicism then very like Irish Catholicism? Was very strict and very guilt-laden.
Yeah, it was very, you know, like we are born of sin and. A very verbal and I don't want to say intellectual. I would just say thinking. It has a lot to do with thinking about your position in the world and guilt and your relation to others. You know, I mean, right? With gospel and with a lot of American forms of religion, you have this very physical, you know, speaking in tongues and chanting and singing and all this, and that probably comes from the African thing. But it also comes from like a folk kind of pagan tradition, I would say, and that was completely absent. So I think the truth is, with music, as a kid, and we sang in school too, in choir, in Chinese school. I was in Taipei in the 70s as a child, and in school, all the Chinese schools had the great masters of music that we have to learn from are Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, blah, 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 all in Chinese, Mozart, Beethoven, Bach. In Chinese on the walls, and we had to sing things like Ode to Joy in Chinese.
I'm this curious as well. Like, I mean, did your mother bring you to church? Were you an altar boy? Were you kind of like Catholic altar boy?
Thank God, no. No, in fact, our mom never made us go to church. Once a year, she said. She was actually quite liberal about this. Isn't religion an interesting topic?
Religion is always an interesting topic. And religion also kind of, like, crosses into the dance floor as well, you know?
It does.
Like, I mean, you talked earlier on about, like, the reaction of those people. I mean, that's like a black gospel church in many ways.
It is. I think so much about this, and, you know, now with all Black Lives Matter and everything, it is relevant, too. And I don't mean that in any, either condemning or praising, whatever. It's just, there's this funny reality that, you know, Europe and especially America imported, kidnapped, Africans brought them over here, and actually these traditions that developed from these people have overtaken the, you might say, the mental, spiritual, musical landscape of the entire world. It's a cliche, really. Mm. You know, but that rhythm, I mean, now I've been living in Germany for 13 years now, and a lot of things became clear in my head because I realized a lot of the disco music that I like to play, and, you know, I think a lot of people here enjoy it too, that's a European tradition, and it does come from Bach. And Bach, and ABBA is a direct descendant of Bach. Because, as you all know, Bach wrote this thing, equal temperament. What is it? Equal temperament keyboard. What is it called? Well-tempered clavier, right? Which actually has a very interesting pretext, which is, as you probably know, if some of you are into classical, there's a cyclical nature to what he does by modulating, by taking the 12 notes and finding out that one goes into the other, circle, fifths, and everything going around and around. You can make a pop song. The most famous of his compositions is probably Air on a G String. Maybe you know it. It's the one that goes, how does it go? Na da 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 na da 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 da. Right? And it goes it goes cyclically. So if you write these chords a certain way over 12 bars or 14 bars, 16 bars, you can go round and round and it never stops. It's like a mantra. It's like a pleasurable thing that swells and dives and goes up and down. But you can do it for hours, right? So in my head, this very curious thing is only being in Europe I realized that. And when I was in the States listening to a lot of black music, and there were certain DJs, you know, especially in New York, they claim, we've got black music, we've got this incredible music, but this music I found quite boring sometimes if you just listen to Fela Kuti from Africa. I'm not saying it's boring, I think the rhythm is very moving, but even if you listen to a lot of contemporary African music, you know, a lot of it is circling around one chord. It's got one major chord. It could be like Ali Touré something, he's, you know, Desert Blues, it can be Fela Kuti, it can be whatever, the strange thing is, musically speaking, musicologically, harmonically speaking, it's still very primitive. You're taking one chord, like dun dun dun, it might be minor chord, usually major chord with the seventh or something, and just repeating on it and jamming on it and arpeggiating on it, like da 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 ba 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 da ba 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 da ba. There are no chord changes. That the specific idea that you have these chord changes which go cyclically over a song and a, you know, blah, 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 into a chorus and a verse and back to a chorus, that excitement really comes from Europe, and it comes from Bach writing the Well-Tempered Clavier, like, what, 300 years ago. And the two things coming together, the chords modulating in a cyclical long pop song format, and the African rhythms, which are also cyclical, but in a sort of a micro cosmic way, you know, like dak dak gak 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 dak 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 gak gak dak dak. If you do the syncopation and all this properly, it does also feel like you could just go on and on. That's what's physically very exciting. And when those two elements come together in, I guess, disco music, funk music, everything that happens after the 60s and 70s, you get something that's really exciting. And I think that's the sort of, I mean, that's a lot of what you hear me hear play when you DJ. But it's almost like the essence of what happens when the magic formula of music of Europe from Bach and on meets the sort of the power and the excitement of African music. That's that ideal middle point there. Mm. And it happens in North America. A different version, I think, happens in South America, where you get like samba, you know, you have a different kind of rhythm, like the heartbeat, right? That's samba, bossa nova, right? It's a different kind of rhythm. Disco rhythm in North America is very 4-4, you know, 1-2-3-4-1, very basic. But no matter what, like Jobim, Antonio Carlos Jobim, said, right, bossa nova is like Chopin melodies played over a samba. That's what it is. It's that tinkly, melancholy piano of Europe, but over a tropical African rhythm. And over and over, all this is combinations of different parts of the African beat over different temperaments of the European soul, I guess you would say. Right,
and like, I mean, something like that revelation, you know, that learning that you just described, that exploration, did that ever occur to you in the States when you were growing up, when you were again DJing for the first time, or do you think something like that only occurs to you with experience? That when you've experienced many different cultures, experienced many different sounds.
Serious question. Okay,
I'm sorry.
I don't know. Yeah, I think it always occurred to me a little more naively, because I really started out naive. When I made my first record in 1993, it was literally, and no false modesty, it was just a guy who had heard some cool disco records and strung them all together on a sampler. I mean, I really knew absolutely nothing.
But like, something like I mean, because you said that actually before about the first Ballyhoo record. You said just loads of mistakes on it. But like, I mean, there's an element of wasabi to that. I mean, often it's the rough edges. It's the kind of the space that attracts people in the first place.
The what? The roughness?
Wasabi. It's kind of the mistakes. The mistakes you leave
in. Oh, wabi-sabi. Yeah. The Japanese aesthetic.
That's my temporary impersonation of a Japanese word. And I failed utterly.
It's entered our common vocabulary. Wabi-sabi. There is a bit more than wabi-sabi. I mean, just naive. It's like a thing you can't recover. In fact, even when I listen to a lot of, I don't know, like, it can be any kind of pop music. Like a lot of reggae or dub music has that quality. It just sounds like people goofing off in the studio. But you just can't get that from a slick, if you approach things from a slick classical or jazz trained background and you're thinking, are all my instruments in tune? Whatever, you just can't get that somehow. It's really hard to let go and work purely in the world of sound and instinct of how things feel and not whether things are theoretically correct.
Yeah, and that's a good word, instinct, because I'm sure the first time you watched a show like Dance Fever and got hooked on that, it was instinct which got you, right?
I think that's the question that's been going on in my head. Are we all programmed to like what we like, or are there absolutes in human culture that you grab onto? And I'm almost tending towards the absolute. What I'm saying is, I did really watch Dance Fever as a child, and it totally grabbed me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys have seen this show. Yeah. You know, like, Dance Fever, dance the night away. It's like, there's a goofy American host called Danny Terrio, who would, like, you know, he's like John Travolta, he's an Italian-American, and they would do dance contests. And it was like all the top 20 hits of 1978 to 1980, you know, every week, with people doing, it's just like Saturday Night Fever. And you know, as a kid, I got totally entranced by that. But I really don't know. You know, like, is it because I got used to that tempo of music and everything that as an adult I still find that pleasurable? I think that with humans, I think there are actually some absolutes that if you take away certain social and economic constraints, that people will really enjoy all kinds of music. And certain kinds of music for example, disco, like Jobim was talking about this stuff too. Bossa Nova functions kind of 120, 260 BPM, beats per minute. You know, DJs are always thinking about this. Certain tempos, are you guys, I'm just curious because I don't want to just talk. Are you guys familiar with the idea of beats per minute, BPM? You all know this, right? And okay, everybody here is, okay, I have nothing more to tell you.
go back to your George Ben. Go back to 120.
There are certain tempos, like 120, it's like the human heartbeat is 60 to 80 or something like that, they say, right? And 120 is just this exciting tempo. When you start walking quickly and your body is kind of excited, like that tempo is 120, right? Boom, boom, checka, dunka, checka, right? And then there's this sort of relaxed, funky tempo of like 90 to 105, 110 BPM, which is that mid-tempo boogie groove, which is very sexy and fun, sure, but kind of relaxed, right? And then there's like the breakneck techno horrible. What's that? What's that word?
Gabber.
Right, which is like. I knew you were going to do that.
That's the first error of Gabbercore beat being dropped. That banter. Thank you very
right?
much.
Okay. And with no judgment, does anyone here like that stuff? No, Gabber, like right. No one, but so I've really, but there are thousands of people, millions of people who are into that. Is it because they're just fucked up? Is it because they had a different socialization as children? Or are their brains ticking at a different tempo? That's a really hard question. I still don't really have the answer to that. I'd like to know. And also, we want to attach certain values because we're kind of cool people and we're groovy and we can get into that natural, cool, you know, where musical arrangement works and all the 16th notes play beautifully and the guitars do their solo and the strings do their, you know, pizzicatos and everything, right? Is that really the superior, proper way to play music? Or is GABA just as good, it's just that we don't get it because our brains are ticking at a different tempo? Mm.
It goes back to what you said earlier on, though, Danny. It goes back to kind of like, I mean, the socioeconomic background, like where you grew mm-hmm. up, your mindset, the politics that's around you, the neighborhood you're in, you know, because if you look at where GABA came from those kind of like rough Dutch estates, you know, like rough Scottish estates. Yeah. That's where it came from. So it's part of that environment, you know?
Does that kind of upbringing turn you off to feeling good inside, you know? Or can we say in an absolute sense that are we correct in feeling good about this? And who's to say that they're not correct in feeling good about, you know, breaking neck? And another example, the counterexample of that, too, to me is very depressing is, you know, I'm sure if you guys know BPM and you're obviously into music, like there's a kind of an old school hip hop funk tempo, which is very comfortable, musical and beautiful, right? Like old, you know, 105, you know, Cool in the Gang, right? This groovy Earth, Wind and Fire, SOS band, all those classic bands from the 70s and 80s, Heat Wave did slow groove funky songs, doom, you know, doom, ba do 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 doom, you know, it could be anything, Funkin' for Jamaica. And then around come the 90s to me, and there's a period where, in the US at least, less so here in Europe and in UK and Ireland, there's much less money going to public schools, and specifically African American communities where this music has its roots, I feel like kids stopped getting their musical education, like harmony and all that disappeared from the sort of the public discourse, but instead a lot of anger and political frustration came in, and then you started getting these bands like Public Enemy and, you know, whatever, which were not music. They were just angry diatribes, totally justified in their anger, over the beats. You're borrowing the beautiful rhythm and bass lines and grooves of the past, but it becomes no longer a musical statement that other human beings can share. It's a very specific polemic using the beat as a kind of a background, as a kind of a, you might say, a candy coating, you know? But that, to me, it's no longer about music. And also, I ask myself when I'm in the States and I hear, you know, see certain, you know, let's say black friends, you know, black people here, you know, smoking weed, and they get, it's very nihilistic. And that always made me very sad. My gay friends, black or white, were not into that. A few friends of mine who were African American, they still live there in Brooklyn or in Chicago. They were into their own thing. They were into, you know, Prince. They were into all kinds of music. They were not into that. But there is also a real segment of society in America or in UK, you know, everywhere now, which is just like there are these GABA people who are into this very unnatural, tense, you know, stressful tempo. There are these people who are into a very nihilistic, dark, hopeless tempo where there's no more musical modulation, There's no more dialogue, you might say, between instruments. There's no instrumentals, actually. It's just people talking and expressing frustration, anger, but also maybe positive emotions. But it's over that beat, and music disappears. And again, I'm asking myself, you know, who has the right answer here? Like, is it their socialization? Are they missing something that we luckily have held on to? Or are we also just deluding ourselves and repeating what we luckily in our youth or childhood were able to absorb, which they didn't have access to?
Yeah.
If we gave, for example, these youth a musical education or all that, would they be able to express themselves better? Or is that just, you know, it's, you know, yeah. Right? Are there right answers?
It's a case of, are there right answers? Because, I mean, like, you know, when you say things like, would they be able to express themselves better? To them, they're expressing themselves in a perfectly, like, I mean, civilized, normal way, you know? It's almost like, it's what makes the world go round in many ways. People are so different, yeah. That makes the world go round. And, like, it'd be curious that instead of, say, for this morning, instead of bringing your box of records over here to Dublin, you decide to bring a box of Gabba records, and you started playing Gabba records at Beach Yard. I'm just trying to imagine the reaction.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it? But, you know, there's a part of me that wants to, like, believe in absolutes, and maybe that's the ideal. Like, what we just had, I don't know if you guys were there at the dance floor, and that was totally not planned. Some kids came and started breakdancing, and, you know, and that is, however, a vision of the world that we probably would like to see. That's what I'd like to see. Yeah. You know, it sounds corny, but it's all colors. There was an Asian kid who started this thing. He was Vietnamese or Thai or Indonesian, I don't know what. He's one shade darker than I am. Wearing his sunglasses, and he just had the moves. He just, you know, busted them out. But then everybody was dancing, and isn't that the vision that we'd like to see? And wasn't that the vision proposed by all the funk and jazz and people in the 70s and the 80s? And you could say that was the gays, of course, in the 70s. Was that not the natural evolution of the so-called civil rights movement and post-colonial discourse, where everybody can talk about what it really means to come from different cultures and different races and grow up with different values, but we find that common point? And so it goes back to that common point that I was talking about. This is one possible ideal scenario where Europe meets Africa, the East meets the West, or the old world meets the new world, and you have this kind of music which everybody can kind of find something beautiful and moving in.
And, like, as I can imagine, as a DJ as well, like, when you get those moments that it all comes together like that, when you get those moments when people are throwing glitter in your face, when they're, like, breakdancing in front of you, like, afterwards, the euphoria must be something else. I mean, could go back to the first times you DJed, you know? Uh-huh. Was it the case of euphoria, or was it the case of learning?
The first time I DJed, I mean, it was really nothing. I was in a little dive bar in San Francisco. It was actually called the Zanzibar, because the owner was this British guy who became obsessed with the New Jersey house scene, and he just, in a tribute to the famous Zanzibar Club in New Jersey, he called his little dive bar in the Mission District in San Francisco the Zanzibar. So he gave me a job there, five people showed up, and that was it. You know, it's not worth mentioning.
No, it's not.
I was going to say, actually, in Japan when I do, it's funny, the same thing, because they've absorbed so much of the U.S. culture, right? Almost in a funny, I don't know if it's in a, if you could say it's in a colonial way. Japanese, as you all know, you know, they're very studious. They live in a monoculture. There are very few black people and Europeans, whatever. That 99.9% of Japanese people have the same hair color, the same eyes, are about the same size, eat the same food, grow up with the same thing. There's no big disagreement. But through absorbing U.S. culture, European culture, they've in a way created sort of multicultural United Nations in their own imagination. And when I play my records, and when, you know, like, doing similar, they really get down. They're, you know, they're very shy. And then a few boys or girls let it out, and they start living out their fantasy. Maybe we're living in the fantasy of Beat Street, wild style, hip-hop culture, all that.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's the ideal, you know, that is the ideal. At what stage did you kind of think to yourself, let's go back to Zanzibar, post-Zanzibar, at what stage did you think to yourself, like, hell, I like what I'm doing here, and you began to kind of realize you can actually kind of, like, create these great moments that you felt great afterwards?
If one can speak of a DJ career, the past 10 years or so, especially after I moved to Berlin, I moved there in 2003, and before that I lived in New York for about 10 years. And, hi, she's one of our favorite dancers. She's the greatest dancer that I've ever seen. More fantasies of singing like a white girl.
There's been a lot of singing today.
There was, yeah.
Yeah, you sang Beethoven earlier on, now a bit of, like...
Actually,
you know,
the Dirty Dancing, that was a good moment.
Okay, cool,
I've had the time of my life.
So you said about, like, I mean, the last 10 years in Berlin.
Yeah, a lot of personal, you know, thing. Really, there's a point in your life where you start asking, what the hell am I doing on Earth? You know, this is Mina. She's my old classmate. We went to a slightly prestigious U.S. university, and she's telling me, yeah, you know, we've got friends now who are like advisors to President Obama, and there's one guy who's like had a PhD in physics, and now he's like the top jazz musician in America or something. And I'm thinking, well, I've sort of like, I feel like the goofy class clown a little bit, you know, because this is like the... Doing DJ and this kind of street culture things, it's like the black market of culture. There's the proper there's the proper way to do culture where you get funding and you go to the right school, you learn to play, you go to, you know, do your auditions, you can show that you can play Bach, you can play all his partitions, and you can play the blah blah blah, you know. Right? That's the proper way to, you know, you go to acting school, you know, you do this, you know, you go to art school, you can emulate the old masters, blah, blah, blah. And then I think there are just some naive people. And to be honest, I'm realizing at age 47 that I'm probably was destined to be one of those people, because it sounds like an apology. I had very goofy parents who had placed no value on any of this. And, you know, it makes me very sad sometimes. But maybe it's my blessing. Never had any money for lessons. Never, you know, no instruments. Even buying a radio cassette was a screaming match in my family. I mean, it was that bad. Mm. You know, it was like, why should you have a radio cassette? Because the kids have it, you know?
Yeah. You know? Go back to what you said there a few minutes ago about, like, you know, the fact that you went through that prestigious university, like your classmates are now kind of like advisors, or whatever. And you were saying, like, about DJing being a funny career for a 47-year-old. I'm paraphrasing here.
I was going to say something more. Yeah, it's more than that. I want to make a really honest confession is, besides all, and talking about Africa and Europe, maybe some of you have remarked on the irony. Sometimes I forget it sometimes, even when I'm looking in the mirror. I mean, I'm actually very Chinese. I mean, my parents claim that they have tape recordings to prove it. I didn't speak any English until I was 6 years old, you know? I mean, they were very Chinese. They were both escaped from China in the 40s and 50s after the war, mm-hmm. against the communists, against the Japanese. My father's father fought against the Japanese in the army. He was with the nationalists. My mom's dad was a politician and was trying to bring democracy to China and everything, but failed completely, still failed. You know, I don't feel very attached to China. And there's this question of, you know, how, I think, like E.M. Forster says about Maurice, one of his famous fictional characters, he's basically born into, I'm not born into an aristocratic family, but Maurice is born into, aristocratic family, he would have been a snob, but there's one thing that saves him, and that's his homosexuality. Because that probably made me go out and have an interface with people I would have never met. You know, specifically a lot of other gay people, a lot of other black people, yeah. from all kinds of socioeconomic backgrounds and with totally different assumptions. Because I always think this, even my mom used to say this quite correctly, a lot of mama used to say, look at Chinese people in the world. When you consider that they're 1/6 of the world's population, they make a lot of things, they're very technically competent, or else they run a restaurant, which is never the best restaurant in town, but it's the one you go to because it's always cheap and it fills you up. There's so much mediocrity. There are so few Chinese things that Chinese people do that are really brilliant, unique, individual. You know, when you consider how many of them there are, you know, and I'm one of them. No, I mean it, really true. And I certainly wonder sometimes what the hell I'm doing. You know, as a kid too, I would tell my parents, you know, Chinese people are dirty, they spit in the street, they look horrible, they're always unkempt, badly dressed. Why can't I just pretend I'm Japanese? And, you know, I used to say this to my parents. And my mom, you know, my dad kind of, you know, my mom with a slight horror, you know, but also kind of an understanding, you know, like, well, China's a really big country and has had to deal with a lot of problems for the past 100 years or so. You know, and when I go to Japan, I feel very welcome, and I've always felt at home there, and they kind of accept me as one, you know, but I still kind of wonder, and I would never want to be like this, the figure. I don't think it's a role I could fill. I don't think I want to fill it, even if it were given to me. I mean, there are some people like Long Long, the great pianist, who I think is actually very camp, you know, all this, like, I'm really feeling this Chopin solo, this prelude, oh, you know, it's like, stop. You know, you're just camp. You're Liberace, okay? You know, and you know, how many other Chinese? Ai Weiwei, maybe. I kind of admire him.
Yeah.
You know, but in terms of politics and all, you're kind of speaking against to a void. You know, I mean, a space void. I mean, if you look at my friend William here, he's kind of an expert on Chinese politics. You wrote me an email 10 years ago even, saying we're still in the dark ages here, we're in the woods and we might never get out. That's what you said about China after living there for like 10 or 15 years, right? Yeah, you did. And recently he just moved his kids back to Ireland because just last year in all the schools in China, they passed out a little red book with dicta from Xi Jinping, the new prime minister, and all the children have to memorize every sentence before they come back to school in the new semester next year, right? I mean, it's kind of horrifically medieval, to speak nothing of the Muslim world. Sorry, not to offend anyone. You know, like, I don't know what I'm doing here, but, you know, it's like I'm the son of Chinese immigrants from California who's having a ball, and I think I've just... I think I've accepted my destiny. I've just given it all. You know, this is.
But this is sometimes you have to do that, Danny. Sometimes you have to accept that. Like, I mean, what you're doing is you're doing it, and you can't kind of think, oh, what could have been?
Yeah.
Oh, I could have been. I could have been kind of like advising Obama on kind of like race relations.
You just hit it on the nose. That's a lot of that, because I think all my life my parents were always saying, you know, you're smart. You know, you have a way with people. You know, you should be doing something for Chinese people. And I've always kind of been like, I don't think it's what I want. You know who I admire? Margaret Cho. Margaret Cho is awesome. I don't know if you've seen her, the Korean-American comedian.
Oh, yeah.
Margaret Cho is just a crazy... It's worth a YouTube.
Okay, Margaret Cho.
She's a bit like me, except she's a comedian on the mic instead of a clown behind the disco turntables, I think. And she's something.
Okay. Like, you know, we've taken a lot of diversions. This was not what I was expecting whatsoever, but it's brilliant. It's been amazing. But you keep mentioning one place, and we haven't really talked too much about it. That's Berlin. You moved there, what, 10, 15 years ago? Like, why did you go to Berlin? Was it love, or was it gigs?
Okay, Berlin, more frankness. At this point, one has nothing to lose. No secrets. All revelations. Several things. Let's see. There was the... low rents, as you've all heard. Still now it's low compared to some other places, but at the time my friends were having like a palace of 100 square meters, two people with three huge balconies, and they were paying like 800 euros between two people for this, you know. It was crazy. Mm. Huge factories you could have for like, you know, I mean, an entire floor of an abandoned factory you could have for maybe 2,000 euros a month, you know. There was a low rent. There was... There were my jobs here, obviously. Flying from Berlin here takes 2 hours. Flying from New York takes 7 hours. To be honest, this gets into that sort of race and culture discussion again. As a gay Chinese man, one assumes the worst about you. in the U.S., and there is that thing about sexual racism and all that. And the funny thing is, in the U.S., the reason why I was often going to gay black clubs was because when I went into the mainstream gay clubs, I found myself feeling quite unwelcome. I mean, that's just the ugly truth. You know, as soon as somebody, it was just, you know, I don't feel like a victim of racism. I've never really felt that,
yeah,
to be honest. But I had, realistically, you know, that is how you feel. You know, there are these tall, muscular, sometimes blonde guys, and they clearly wanted to be with each other. And if they saw someone like me or a dark-skinned person, they would just look away. That was it, you know, and... So maybe I should be grateful that through that, somehow I was very accepted in the black gay clubs. This whole scene like Paris is burning and voguing, I met a lot of those people too. And even though I never felt like I was pretending to be one of them, I think they felt like obviously there was an exchange, that they had something to show me and I had something to show them. So they did. I mean, you know, these African-American friends of mine let me into their life. You know, we'd go to dance contests together. And of course they played me all their records, you know, that they found interesting.
Yeah.
But when I got to Berlin, suddenly the situation reversed. My friends would joke that you have the Ausländer bonus, the foreigner bonus. Everything that was not blonde-haired and blue-eyed, like me, who walked into a club, was suddenly like, you know, I would have these big, well-built guys come and be like, hi, you're kind of cute. It's like, you know, really, that's the truth. And, you know, it was a bit flattering, also a bit sort of shocking. And then I suddenly started thinking, okay, this is just, you know,
enjoy
kind of fun. Did I enjoy it? Oh, must you ask?
There's no need to answer that. No need to answer that.
I know. I did tell my mom that once. I finally said something like, Mom, you know, I'm actually very promiscuous. You're very Catholic. You know, I just, that moment in every gay man's adult life when they want to shock their parents to death. I've had sex with a lot of guys, and I really like it, and it's made me the person that I am. And I hope you don't mind me saying that. And I could hear that silence over the phone.
Has she been to Berlin to see you? Huh? Has she been to Berlin to see you?
Yeah, yeah, she came to visit me before I said that.
Oh, okay.
She was going through a God phase again a few years ago, so I think that's when I pulled that one on her. This is really like a Margaret Cho comedy routine now.
Okay. Is Berlin of today the same for you as it was when you first landed?
It definitely, you've all heard this, it's gotten more expensive, definitely. The rents have gone up like 30 or 40%. My apartment, which still cost me about 500, 550 a month, is going for 800 euros now. The exactly same 50 square meters, you know. And I think they've introduced some measures, like for those who are thinking of moving there, German language requirement. Now, all my friends who go there seem to have to take, I think they have to take like 3 to 6 months obligatory German course and then pass a test at the end, so they can get their extension of their 2 or 3 year visa. And I remember it wasn't like that 10 years ago when I got there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's gotten a bit harder. But okay. But I think maybe you should move, anybody should move to some place with the feeling that they want to participate in the life there. I mean, you don't just move to somewhere because there's cheap rents.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you want to get to know your neighbors.
Really get culture.
Yeah, I mean, it bothers me, to be honest, when my foreigner friend neighbors, you know, whoever they might be, when they take no interest whatsoever in speaking to their neighbors, I think that's just really rude. But yeah, same thing here, right? Yeah,
totally. Last couple of questions for me, you know, and it's been a great conversation, because it's like you've just done all the talking and you've steered the conversation. But I want to steer it back as opposed to music again, you know. What are the last couple of records that you were really, really happy you've played? And what's been the record release you had on Ballyhoo you're most proud of?
Oh, curious question. okay, if you guys know it. There is a Ballyhoo number 8. That was the blue one with a kind of funny printed railroad-looking graphic on it. I always liked that one because it had all those weird combinations of elements that I talk about. Like, there's a sort of a parody of a Giorgio Moroder bit, and there's this weird sort of, like, high-energy leather man.
Me, with my voice pitched down,
talking in French, saying, "Come here, I want you. You're my little boy. Come be with my little boy forever," you know, disguised. And then there's this weird sort of Afro-groovy track where there's a conga. It's a very African pattern, the conga pattern, but then there's a vocoder and a synthesizer. So this is like what we were saying.
Yeah.
This weird combination of parts of a fantasy of European sounds, of that melancholy or that orchestration, and then the fantasy of kind of an African rhythm underneath that the pulse that drives it.
Cool, okay.
But the concept.
Of right. And then in terms of the last couple of records you would have played that you really, that there was a reaction on the dance floor that you went, hell, this is why I do this.
Oh, you mean today?
Oh, in the last while, not just even today.
You know, today, can I apologize? If you guys were there, it was like Michael Jackson, Madonna. What else was there? Dr. Beat by Miami Sound Machine. It was all like really obvious hits.
But sometimes...
It's good, yeah.
But there's a phrase that people use all the time about guilty pleasures. I hate that phrase.
Sister Sledge, Bee Gees.
But that's all great music.
Yeah, it's great music. And furthermore, there's a slight reason. It's because... not apologizing, but technically the stage was bouncing. It was almost impossible to mix. So any fancy layovers or things, you know, there are tricks that DJ use where you can slip in a record that no one knows, and if you mix it well enough, suddenly it's there and people are already in the groove and they're following you. But in this kind of situation, you're all DJs here, you know this, it's impossible to just, to use those tricks to sell that record that you're playing, so I just went for the obvious things.
Okay, right.
Really. But, I mean, what did I... Let's see. There were a couple of good things in there. There were a couple of good things in there.
A couple of... You can't think of them.
I can't remember it. I mean... It's all good.
It's all good.
Oh, yeah,
good.
There's an old favorite. You guys know, like, Asso Don't Stop? It was like a little sort of jazzy 80s breakbeat piano, a purely instrumental track. That's always a good one to
play. What's it called?
ASSO, Asso, means ace in Italian, like an ace of cards, an ace of base. Don't Stop.
Asso Don't Stop.
Yeah, it's just a jazz piano instrumental. But again, that's the whole Bach thing. It's if you play the chords and play the harmonies correctly, even a simple instrumental track has all the excitement of break and verse and chorus and bridge. And, you know, it creates tension, like a lot of great pop songs. You start out with a motif, you insert an element which forces attention into that thing. It might be a seventh chord, it might be a drum pattern, it might be a crescendo that swells up, and you want to know what happens after that swell. And then it breaks into a different thing. So, yeah? Cool. So, yeah.
Last question for me. What's the next gig?
The next gig, I think, isn't it tonight at 1 o'clock in the morning at Wigwam? I really just...
Danny Wang, everybody. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for being such a good sport and going along with it, even though you didn't have a clue up to, until 10 to 6 you were doing this.
Yeah, really. I really didn't know. I mean, you know, thanks for being here and listening through. Sometimes there's a lot of talking now. Like, there's like Red Bull. Every week there are all these thousands of DJs. Everybody's interviewing
But you see, I think it's really interesting. We've been doing these banter talks since 2009. They're public interviews. We've done about 150 of them.
And my nephews are here.
150 of them or so. But like... But like I think people are curious about this. People want to get it. And the Red Bull, like I mean, one of the Red Bull interviews you did, I was watching. I didn't even watch some of it. It was 2.5 hours long.
The thing that I did.
Yeah.
That's quite. It's a lot of the same topics here. I should say also without now dropping. You know, sometimes there's a sort of modesty on my part because I sometimes do feel this is going back to the thing about not being really classically trained. I think I know my music theory well enough, but sometimes I do wonder who's really qualified to speak about all this stuff, because a lot of the DJs have been doing it forever. I mean, there are DJs who've been playing for 30 or 40 years. There are different ways that people approach music, and some of these DJs that I know who are considered very good DJs actually are musically quite clueless. I mean, if you ask them what music really is, and they're just sort of like playback machines, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. They know from personal experience what works on a dance floor. Play a certain record and you'll get a certain reaction, everybody's hands will go in the air. But I feel like my perspective is, there are different perspectives. I like to think that there is this pure thing called music that works in absolutes and ideals, that a certain rhythm pattern is exciting, certain chords are exciting. That value in itself, in that piece of music, recorded music, is just going to make people get up and feel something physically and emotionally, even if that piece of music is totally unknown. Right, that's what the so-called diggers are doing. They're trying to find those lost gems which have that same value, musically speaking, but weren't historically, experientially sort of marked by the old school DJs as this is a hit, you know? And I don't know. I mean...
I think a lot of talks, especially on the Red Bull thing, it's sometimes you get these amazing experiences. Like I remember being in the room when Masters at Work were being interviewed, and just
Masters at Work.
Yeah, and they were talking.
Okay, I want to hear what you're going to say because you've
theories. Okay.
Yeah. We're going over time. Sorry.
No, don't worry about it. But like you know, there was times when it just seemed to be about, okay, this record moved me in this way. There was nothing deeper than that.
Okay, then I'm glad you're saying.
Then the following day, Brian Eno was speaking, and that was totally different.
Who?
Shit. Brian Eno.
Oh, Brian Eno, of course, come on.
He started off talking about hospitals, and that was great, music in hospitals.
Okay, I will perfectly reflect your sentiment. Masters at Work to me were a nightmare in the 90s because they were clearly two very unmusical people who got thrust this job of becoming the masters of house music. I mean, one of them was my customers at the shop. When you meet unmusical people, you know it. And this is now getting very personal, but I've met, it's in the dance music community especially, strangely, there are a lot of people who are actually maybe atonal or non-harmonic or non-musical. They literally don't hear tones. I've gone several times with people to studios, and I'm playing them like I'm not saying you have to know this to be musical, but a C and a C sharp, like a black key, and a white key and the black key next to it. There's a half tone. Now, there's a reason there are 12 tones on the keyboard. So I'm singing this note. Do, re, mi, do, da, 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 da. And I play it, and they sing, wah, wah. It's really like a duck quacking, and I'm thinking, this can't be real. This guy has dedicated his life to making music and making a career out of it. But it suddenly dawns upon that person and me that in their head there's no pitchfork at all. Yeah. It's very disturbing to me, actually. Huh? That's possible, because I've also met people like that who can play. They find the harmonies, reasonably simple harmonies, but it's true. And then, but they don't necessarily match. They're not used to matching their vocal cords to the thing they hear outside. But to me, there is a certain ideal of making music, which is you've got this inner voice. That's the theory, at least. The inner voice is a voice that sings in pure tones and blah, 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 and harmonies. And somehow you find the external expression in composing and playing, which matches that thing that you want to say inside, right? I mean, that's really lofty now, but that's what makes music work. It's you're grabbing people's heart directly. And it's very disturbing to me when you meet people who talk about being like them. They're very arrogant, actually, Master of the Work. Yeah. We're old school, we're masters of music, we're the nephew of this great, you know, salsa singer.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're completely atonal. And I know this because they came to our shop, they were playing music, and I would think, this is weird. Or all the records they produce, the melody is out of tune with the bass line, the entire 9 minutes. You know, they're singing an E, and the bass line is like, in, you know, who knows, an A. No, no, that would be harmonic, actually. Yeah. That's a fifth. Sorry. So, yeah, it's very disturbing that people like that also get interviewed. Maybe it's also fair. Maybe it's saying that music is more than just melody and harmony. I don't like to think that, but...
Yeah, I think for an awful lot of people, melody is more than that, because melody is also about the packaging around, and you just kind of, like, mean... Because honed in on certain reasons why Master's work was so revered. There's the history, there's the whole New York House thing, there's a Don's, there's a Names, there's the tradition.
It seems to me a great also injustice. It's a bit like... It's kind of a tyranny in a way. It is... the tyranny of the masses, or populism. It is populism.
Or the triumph of mediocrity.
Yeah, exactly that too. But translated into a cultural sense. I mean, some painters and all that, same thing. Mm. But again, in some senses, maybe there's no absolute right answer. We're saying, this is the question, in music, is there this thing called the right answer?
I don't think so.
And there are people, like, just an example, Elton John, they might play everything harmonically, you know, made some great tunes in the past, but often I think it's weird. Something here is wrong. It's all harmonically, you know that with Elton, certain, you know, it's all harmonically correct. It's a well-written song. It's got a concept. It's got lyrics. But something about it emotionally falls flat. And then I used to listen to Sade songs, and when I was young, I used to think, these things are so harmonically simple. Like, they're not grabbing me. I just want that jump up to a big major chord where everything explodes. But as I'm getting older, I used to just like her a lot, and now I completely love listening to Sade, because I'm thinking, you know, this is not someone being clever. This is not music thought and constructed. It's about feeling.
Yeah.
It's not about how the person who composed it is. It's about your reception as a listener, how it makes you feel inside, and it's a deeper wisdom in a way to accept.
Totally,
that.
And like, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Shadi, because I mean, her backing band, Sweetback, some of the albums they've done have been extraordinary in that kind of way, again, the way you kind of receive that music and the way you react to it.
Yeah, Brian Eno too, same way. If you take apart, like, you know, ambient, the albums or Music for Airports, they're extremely, extremely simple. But it's the execution and the construction and the reception.
Yeah.
He's made this on purpose that makes you feel, it makes you feel something if you let yourself go. You know, and get into it.
I think that is a fantastic way to end. Danny Wang has just let himself go. Big round of applause.
Many thanks to Danny for joining us at Banter at Beatyard. This podcast was recorded by Dylan Higgins and produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. Check out thisisbanter.com for news of our upset banter in the coming weeks. Plus, you can also listen back there to all the banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.